This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Bombastic, audacious, revolutionary, rash, outraged, organised, assertive, activist.
Broad. On Joy 94.9.
The Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I want to pay my respects to the elders past and present. And I want to acknowledge that this is stolen land that sovereignty was never ceded. And I think not only is that a true fact and something that I think is always really important to point out, but I think it's something that's going to come up today. When we think about culture wars and we think about women of colour from Oceania region. So today we're hosting a panel and it's called The Colours of Purple and Black, Queer and Trans Women of Colour of the Culture Wars, but I'm not happy with that title even though I wrote it, and I think that I wrote that title so you would understand what I mean when I say Queer and Trans Women of Colour in the Culture Wars, but I think that that title in itself is something that can be contested today. Women, queers, people of colour, creating culture, changing culture, redefining culture. Culture is a living, breathing thing and we're a part of it. The groups of people that we're talking about, which I include myself, are and have been both at the epicentre and the margins of contemporary cultural wars, but we usually don't have a chance to sit and listen to queer women of colour speak about our experiences of queerness, of transness, and whatever the hell it is that we are. How do we see ourselves in this so-called post-culture war society? Are we post-culture wars even? It's not that a queer trans woman of colour is queer and a person of colour. She's queer in the context of being a person of colour. We're queer in the context of being women of colour. Both things are often multiplied and amplified against one another to compound our complexities and the effects that this has on our lives. So I am a queer woman of colour. My name is Lana. I, last year in Melbourne, held monthly forums called Queers and Answers to discuss some of the issues that we experience and face and are involved in, and I brought the panel back for the conference today, and I brought some wonderful people with me, and the two people I know that are very quiet. So we have Daisy, who's a 22-year-old, a young'un. She's a Bard and Yaru woman from Western Australia that has been living in Melbourne for 7 years. Although Danny is an active member within the LGBTIQA and Indigenous communities here in Melbourne, it wasn't until the last few years that she started to observe the spaces she was a part of and reflect on. Her interest in the culture wars began when she realised that her being gay and being Aboriginal are two completely different experiences that managed to merge into one and create a third and a whole new complex experience. And we have Sonia. Sonia Hanna is a producer and presenter for Joy 94.9 radio show Broad, and genre podcast Sci-Fi and Screen. Broad is a weekly live-to-air feminist intersectional woman-centric space broadcast from Joy, which is an LGBTIQA station. She's a coordinator of the fan and advocacy group Queer Geeks of Oz, and Sonia organised the all-female geek panel and podcast called Geek Girls Speak, talking about women and girls in the nerd culture. Sonia was one of the panellists at the Midsummer 2015 Cartooning with Pride event to discuss issues facing LGBTI comic book industry in Australia. She also held discussion panels at places like the Melbourne Queer Festival, Queer Film Festival, about the representation of queer women characters in horror films like Sapphic Suckers. One of Sonia's projects has the co-development of a zine called Quartz, Queer Art Zine, to further promote LGBTI talent in our community. And it goes on and on. Sonia's
It goes on and on, actually. It's probably a bit long.
Yeah, well, I, you know, it's interesting because I've known this woman for a long time, and you know, she's a friend of mine, but it's not until we read bios and we go, God, you've done so much.
Or I just copied and pasted it.
We have another panellist, Maya, who is running late. She's a very busy woman, and I will introduce her when she comes. But this is the last session for this conference. We've spent the conference talking about the culture wars. We've spent the conference thinking about aspects of the culture wars. But I think that for this panel, I want to discuss what is the culture war. So going back to the very beginning session with Anne-Marie and kind of unpack a little bit of what the culture wars are. So I want to ask you, Sonia, what do the culture wars mean for you?
It's a very big question, of course. What it means is, as a person with some feedback going on, I'll try and hold it up there. I think that... Is that so right? Yeah. Stand on the outside of the room, perhaps. I think it's been possibly something that I've become more aware of having moved from Aotearoa to Australia. I've noticed it a lot more, I guess, with representation. For me, it's about visibility, or in this case, invisibility, Indigenous visibility, and also the things that, I guess, the dominant white culture, how that has affected, inflicted in many ways, sort of standardised culture that we're all supposed to follow on with and I guess be accepting of. Yes, I also think probably in the last 20 years it's become more significant what the culture wars mean for Indigenous people in particular. I hope that helps.
I think that it's a really good start, so thank you.
Okay.
And I'm just going to point out that one of the first things you said was Indigenous, not queer or LGBTI. Dani, what does the culture wars mean for you?
Well, we were just having this conversation before, actually, because I was a bit nervous about answering this question, and the way that I kind of explained it before is I feel like I've always experienced what it is to be a part of these culture wars, the two cultures kind of colliding and which one is more dominant or superior than the other, but I never had a word for what it actually was, and the word is apparently culture wars. I guess recently that term has become, got a lot more meaning to it now for me as I've started to realise. I've got an example is a lot of people have been asking me where to prefer to live, Broome or Melbourne, and I said it's not that there's a preference, it's just that back home I get to be more black, whereas in Melbourne I express my gay side a lot more, and that I guess for me kind of is a living experience for me of what it is to be a part of these culture wars. What you were saying, we're not in the post-culture wars now, it's still happening.
So you've both talked about, in unpacking the question, what is the culture wars, you've talked about a war between Indigenous identity and queer identity as such, to put a big umbrella term on for the moment. You know, when we look up online what the culture wars are, it's a battle between conservative and liberal over conflicting cultural, moral and religious ideas. Do you think that there is the culture war limited to being a woman of colour and being queer, or do the culture wars move out further from that? You know, do you fit perfectly, for example, in the queer culture?
No.
Or do you fit perfectly in the Indigenous culture, or are there other cultures and intersections happening?
Yeah, I think there are so many intersections happening. This is a hard question also, because people interpret the word culture completely differently. For me, when I hear the word culture, I associate that with obviously being Indigenous or being an Aboriginal woman. So yeah, it was interesting getting this question and then realising, wow, there have been all of these other different kind of cultures being created, and so now the word culture for me just means being a part of particular communities that have been categorised as gay or even being a woman. So I think, yeah, culture wars expands further out than just being a queer or a woman of colour or whatever. I think, yeah. Yeah, I hope that answers the question.
I don't think it's about having answers. I think it's about opening up the questions.
I think the same, actually. I think particularly the last 20 years, I would say, it's queer culture in Australia, New Zealand, or the South Pacific at least, significantly has got more of a flag. There's more, I suppose you could say, I think there's more flag waving in some respects, more categorisations. The rainbow seems to be getting broader and broader, and it's knowing where to fit into that rainbow, and it's not, it still feels quite new as far as that. And like Danny was saying, when I think of culture, I don't think immediately queer, gay, lesbian, trans, or those particular categories. I immediately think of what the original culture is and what it's doing.
So we all come from nations which are colonised and are all significant in our own cultural backgrounds as wars. So in New Zealand, there was the Musket Wars, which killed half of the population. And there was Christianity and the Christian missionaries that came in. And really, there was a culture war within New Zealand where New Zealand Maoris are now like 15% of the population, comparative to the European, which is, I think, 65%. And then there's South Pacific Islanders, which make up the rest. You know, we had the frontier wars in Australia. Where does... What do you know, I guess, is the first question, about traditional ways of being in terms of gender and sexuality comparative to Western notions of LGBTIQ?
Oh, well, for Aotearoa from New Zealand, it's sexuality is almost like the branding of sexuality, I suppose, is an introduced idea. It's an introduced idea by the colonisers at the time to, I guess, in what I think is trying to certainly oppress the indigenous or native population. It's pretty much like that all around the world, even in North America as well. But in New Zealand, the term that's been used a lot in the last 10, 15 years has been called takatapui. Takatapui sort of is an umbrella for indigenous people, Maori people there, for the different facets of sexual relations. So it really means, it really describes technically the sexual relations you have with a person. It doesn't actually mean gay, lesbian, trans, any of those concepts, those constructs. So when you say you have relations with someone, is it a takatapui relationship? In other words, same-sex relationship? Is it a trans relationship, so-called? Is it gay? Yeah. Or is it straight? You know, hetero... Well, it's not going to be heteronormative, but it could be bisexual and going towards more of a straight type of sexuality, type of relations.
I've specifically chosen people that aren't academics to be on this panel to give queer women of colour voices that we don't hear.
It'd be nice.
No, and so I probably have a little bit more knowledge than you from an academic viewpoint because I've been researching this particular topic for a couple of years. And in New Zealand, from what I can tell, is there was no word for same-sex sexual relationships, and that's actually right over the South Pacific. But there are words that are used to describe, I guess the best translation that I can put is gender liminal spaces. And so, for example, in New Zealand, it is...
well, it's a devotion.
Whakawahine
and Bossy woman, I think it's called.
Yeah. And so whakawahine is what we would translate in a Western culture as... like a woman, but it also leaves space for being like a man, and so it is really a gender liminal space. And yet sexuality, as far as I can tell, pre-colonial times, it just doesn't matter. It's not. Do you think that with the resurgence of new words, in traditional ways, that there's more or less acceptance of same gendered relationships?
Yes, I think so, but we've also, the unfortunate thing, because I'm an atheist, you know, the unfortunate side of it is with these, I guess, restructurings of these words and terms has also come quite a strong force of the new wave of Christianity, and that has, in my opinion, infected a lot of Māori traditions and Māori culture. And what it has meant is there's been a quite a virulent anti-queer, anti-same-sex within the Indigenous culture. So there's been this real, I don't know if you've heard of Brian Tamaki, quite recently we had the terrible earthquakes in New Zealand in the last, what, still ongoing actually, I think it was 4.8 yesterday morning, felt in the central North Island. And he is a man who runs this very conservative church over there and is spouting off things saying, this is because of the Takatapu people. This is because of the gays. Mm-hmm. The gays have created this earthquake. We've all heard that rhetoric before, haven't we? Mm-hmm. In other parts of the world and here as well.
Yeah.
But it's sort of becoming very fire and brimstone and predominantly dominated by Māori within those churches.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a schism, and it does make it quite a potentially a very scary environment for queer people at the moment.
So just to go back in time a little bit, New Zealand was colonialised. There was the treaty.
Well, there is the treaty.
There is the treaty.
Yeah.
The treaty is dead in existence.
Is a thing.
It is a thing.
Well,
and it's a thing in response to the colonial government policies, which Maoris actually had to assert the sovereignty and say, no, actually, this isn't your land, and then put in place a treaty. It did have a whole Christian missionary thing, like did most of the islands, and it did have the same kinds of white Australia policies that Australia had, which is why there's such a larger amount of Europeans there than Maoris. And so with that first wave of Christian missionaries coming through colonialising, you're saying that there's another wave now?
It's like an internal colonialising of Christianity, but coming within. From Māori themselves. And when I was living in Rotorua in the central North Island 20 years ago, I could see it happening. You would go along to go to the local pub, whatever it be, like a queer night, because it was predominantly 70% Māori population in a particular town. And you would have Christians waiting out the front doors, handing out leaflets. But the difference was they weren't white people. They were cousins, they were Māori people, and it was like young Māori people. It was like, what is happening? Because maybe a month beforehand, there was a young guy I saw. I said, oh, I saw you here at the club. And he said, no, you're mistaken. You need Jesus. And I was like, okay. And of course, there's a famous church there too, in a place called Ohinimutu, which looks out over Lake Taupo. You walk into the church, the first thing you see is beautiful glass windows. It was made in the 1870s or 80s. And it's a brown Jesus with his full-on feathered cloak walking over the water. The way you look at it, if you angle yourself properly, it looks like he's walking on Lake Taupo and he's a Māori chief.
Mm-hmm.
But he's Jesus. So...
So there's culture wars within culture wars.
Mm.
Danny, you're a youngin'. You're like the next generation. You're the same age as my daughter, actually.
Oh, well.
and so I guess my question is, and I'll put this in context, my daughter is also a queer woman. She's had different struggles than I have. There's a whole generational gap. And so her queerness is, she got really grumpy that I didn't get upset that she came out to me. And she's never been to a queer club because she doesn't feel like she ever needs to. She doesn't need those safe spaces. She can be queer and she feels comfortable and supported in being queer in her own way. What does it look like for you to be queer in your community, in your family?
That's a hard question. So I basically I guess, came out to my family when I was 16, 17, but I was in Melbourne at the time and I just sent out a mass message. It was like, they can deal with it. But for me, what going back to sort of the whole Christianity kind of thing, my mum's side of the family is quite Catholic. So that was interesting to see how that was going to play out. Because I remember, you know, I would go to church every Sunday when I was younger and had a lot of internalized homophobia. But my mum is like the biggest chiller in the world, so she was fine with it. One of the main aspects that worried me was my dad is one of 8 men. That's very, very masculine, heteronormative family. Had obviously also been influenced by the huge Catholic sort of community up that way, because Lumbardino, which is the community that I'm from, was actually a mission. So it was a lot harder to express sort of, my queerness to my dad's side of the family, because it was very, heteronormative and had that sort of religious undertones throughout the whole community.
Were there any signifiers or role models of what queerness might look like from an Indigenous perspective that you ever saw growing up?
So in Broome we have Mary G, who is a man from one of the big families who dresses as a woman and would do all these different skits and stuff. So, I mean, Broome is a little bit more, because it's a larger town, there was a bit more space for people to express their queerness. So I always saw that, but I mean, because I grew up in Lumbardino for the first 7 years with my dad's family, and then I moved to Broome when I was a bit older. So I guess I was probably still in a headspace that was quite homophobic or just narrow-minded. So I guess I couldn't fully take on like what those spaces meant to me, or if they were actually role models to me. Now when I look at it, I think it's quite amazing. Also my uncle, so one of my dad's brothers is gay, but he moved away when he was 18 because that's something he felt he needed to do for himself, so he moved to Sydney. So I guess I never had that for me there. I always knew about him, and I knew that he moved away and that he was gay, and it was a big thing. So,
The person that we've got coming is Amio, and she is a Fafafini woman, so she will be able to give us an understanding of what it means to come from Oceania and really think about gender in terms of colonialisation. But the three of us come from cultures, Maori, Indigenous, First Nations, Australian and Fiji, where there's no mention of same-gendered relationships, and same-gendered relationships in my culture is very taboo, whereas gender liminality is an understood cultural practice. You talked about the understanding of Mary G and dressing up, and queerness as an umbrella as being different, but was there any indication for you growing up that same-gendered relationships, or that women could have relationships with women in any kind of Indigenous sense?
I actually, once I started to get a bit, like when I think of when I was 18 and that whole thing happened with Anthony Mundine after the Redfern showed that episode with the two men, I called up my uncle and I said, because like I never, what we were saying before, there's never been a word for same-sex relationships, there's never been anything to do with same-sex relationships in our language that I can remember. And for Indigenous culture in general, stories are passed down by word of mouth, and I've never ever heard a story of a man or a woman in a same-sex relationship being punished for being in that. Because that's, you know, if you do something wrong back home, traditionally the law is you'd probably get a spear to the leg. And that, you know, I've never ever heard any stories about people being gay or being a lesbian or whatever getting a spear to the leg. And, yeah, so after that Anthony Mundine thing happened, I called up my uncle who's gay and I was like, was this ever an issue traditionally, I guess, before colonisation? And he was like, no. So, sorry, I kind of almost sort of forgot the question.
No, that's okay. You've answered it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We've talked a little bit about our experiences, or you've talked about your experiences of what queerness might mean from a traditional sense. I wonder what your experiences is being queer, or being a person of colour, or a woman of colour in Western queer spaces. Is there an experience to talk about?
Yeah. This is a, yeah, that's a big one. I wrote down, actually, in my notes that being black, being a lesbian, and being a woman are all completely different experiences in themselves. It just so happens to be that I'm wrapped up in all of them in one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, coming to Melbourne and being able to express my queerness more, I've noticed that the queer spaces are here very white dominated, which is interesting. I was at a gay night last week, and Treaty, they did a remix of Treaty song at the club, and it was a really awkward and weird feeling to kind of have, you know, two of, I guess, my cultures colliding, because I've always seen queer spaces as very white. And going back to the whole religious thing as well, I feel like with colonization and the rise of religion in Australia, Catholicism, Christianity, I feel like, yeah, we all got kind of... They made a bigger deal about being queer or being black. You know, these categories were created by colonization, whereas, like, yeah, I've never seen them as a big deal before within myself being younger, if that makes any sense. Yeah. So
are you saying that they've become more of a big deal the more you've been able to inhabit them and label them?
Yeah, as in, I've never... The best way that I can kind of describe it is I've always known I've been black. I've always been proud of being black. It wasn't until I came into sort of more dominated Western spaces that the whole waving flag thing came about, where it's like, no, I have to show that I'm black, or I have to prove that I'm black, or I have to prove that I'm gay by constantly going into these spaces that are safe spaces for us, or where we can show that we're proud. Like, when I'm at home, so I'm a light-skinned person of colour, obviously, and that's because there was a lot of different cultures in Britain, a lot of Asian influence and stuff like that. And back home, people will look at me and they'll know I'm black, whereas when I'm here in Melbourne, which is obviously quite a white city compared to home, people then ask you, oh, but you're half, right? You know, like, that's something that I'm the biggest thing I can kind of compare to.
On the way here, I came from Sydney to come here. On the way here, I got asked where are you from, and I said Australia, and they're like, yeah, but where are you from? Which is interesting, because my kids get that as well, and they're Indigenous, so they can just go stuff you.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay, so Sonia,
yep.
Throwing that question to you, how does your, if we go and look at you as an Indigenous woman from Rotorua or I've been there, I've been to Rotorua, and we look at your understanding of queerness in your traditional context, what is the experience for you as a woman, a queer woman of colour in Western spaces?
I guess just for a background sort of background, you know, a bit of context as well. The dilemma I have, of course, is very similar to what Dani was saying. It's that coming from a mixed culture as well, coming from, you know, people... I've got a friend who's got a very similar background to me, and she's Māori as well, but raised in Australia with a Māori father that still resides in New Zealand, but a white mother who's Australian, so from a separated family. And I've actually come across quite a few queer... gay Māori who are basically raised here in Australia, And constantly, yeah, it's a world that they have to inhabit, which is A, they feel like they have to identify who they are all the time.
Well, I'm asking you from, because you grew up in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And you're here now. Mm. But growing up in New Zealand, growing up in your family, and then coming to Australia, mm-hmm. what is your experience now with your identities that you inhibit? What is your experience here now?
Here now, as an older sort of woman, I guess, older wahine, I get asked to do things now.
Like the young panels?
Yeah, I get asked to do that. I get asked what I think about Indigenous issues in Australia. I have been roped in, I would call it, to represent Indigenous people in Australia, and I've had to actually say, actually, I can't do that because it's not my place. I'm a foreigner as well, just like everyone else here, apart from Dani, or if there are any other traditional people here. That does happen, and so it's been a real learning curve of how to navigate that, especially as a queer woman as well.
Yeah.
So being told, you know, these are the labels that you have to work with within, and it's like the labels are sort of thrown upon me for me to work in those as an outsider. Like a double outsider,
yeah.
That makes sense. I feel like a double outsider.
Yeah.
But as a biracial, queer, lesbian, atheist, geek, it's quite tricky. It's quite tricky.
Yeah.
And you know, thankfully I've made friends with some people from Kulin Nation, other nations here in Australia, and I can relax a little bit more. But I do feel that there is certainly a lot of labels that had to endure, work with.
So are you saying that it's harder being in queer spaces in, say, Melbourne?
Yeah, I think it is harder.
Yeah.
It's because, it's a dominated, very white, gay, male-centric culture.
Why do you think that is? Like, and I throw this out because I find the same thing, that queer spaces, queer signifiers of gayness are white, male, cis-normative, Kylie Minogue, pop, and that's actually not representative of our community, and yet that is the signifiers that we see, that is the experience that we have often, unless there's little pockets that we can find and get into. Why do you think that is?
I think it probably goes back to some of the original, perhaps some of the original gay movements in Australia, perhaps in Melbourne, are more heavily dominated by white culture as such. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. You know, the movement had to happen, as it has globally, of course. But I think the difference is, I don't think we had a stone wall as such. Because as far as representation of diversity, because Stonewall in the US did have, as far as I'm aware, it did have people of colour, it did have Latinx people, representative people, black, indigenous, native, queer people within that space too. But I'm not aware of that similar type of thing happening here, politically.
Yeah. I'm wondering whether that's because we come from places where gayness isn't something that we highlight. We've not traditionally had words for it. We're not going to get a spear in the leg for it. So is it something that maybe isn't necessary? Isn't that important?
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you as a younger person.
I think... Yeah, I agree with what you were saying, Sonia. And also I think that it also comes down to the whole, like, collective, the community sense versus, like, the whole individualistic, like, Western idea of ourselves. And what you were saying before, how you noticed that when we introduced ourselves or when we sent you our bios, the first thing that we noted was our background or where we're from. So I feel like for me, I am fighting more for my rights as an Aboriginal person than I am as a gay person, not because I value that more or that, you know, I just think that my Aboriginality, for want of a better term, is more of who I am as a person than my queerness, to say, because I feel like, yeah, I don't know how else to really explain it.
I guess you're hitting on a really interesting point if we think about indigeneity in Australia, or if we think about indigeneity pretty much anywhere in the world, in a world in which is constantly new forms of colonialization and imperialization constantly fighting as small groups of people in isolated nations. Sometimes that war is more important because it is, as much as the queer community is in danger, as much as the distress and, you know, LGBTIQ people in Australia have the second highest rates of suicide, for example, in the nation, but the highest rates of suicide are actually Indigenous people. It is Indigenous people that communities are being closed. It is the Racial Discrimination Act still in existence, that the Racial Discrimination Act in the territory still suspended after 10 odd years. Is your indigeneity something that is more urgent to focus around?
Yeah, well, for me, yes. And especially because where I'm from in the Kimberley, we have the highest rates of, like, youth suicide at the moment. Nearly, you know,
in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember when I was in year 10 back home, and we had like the year 10 retreat, and two boys from my school were walking back to the hostel, and they literally saw someone hanging from a tree, like an Aboriginal person hanging from the tree. So when you experience stuff like that so constantly in your life, like as an Aboriginal person, it kind of takes a cake on what sort of, like, rights you're fighting for more. It's not that I don't value my gayness or think that the gay community is suffering less than the Aboriginal community. It's just, yeah.
At this time and place.
Yeah, at this time and place, that's what's kind of more important to me. And I feel like there is more support at this moment in time for the queer community. And that's from my own experience, though. I mean, it's obviously different for everyone. But yeah, that's just kind of how I feel. There's less support for issues that Indigenous.
Yeah. Sonia, you and I have a pretty long friendship now. I don't know, a couple of years at least.
Oh, yeah, a couple of years.
Well, I haven't been in Melbourne for nearly a year.
Okay.
So, a couple of years at least. We really bonded around our background as Pacific Islanders, as well as queer women. And we often get together and make jokes. I made one to you the other day when you were being political, and I'm like, oh, you're not going to be like a loudmouth, political, queer woman of colour, are you?
Someone contacted me over that. He said, who's that woman that wrote that? Are you okay? And I was like, it's fine.
Yeah,
she's
where do all these things intersect for you in terms of the work you do? Because you do work in queer spaces, but in those queer spaces really fighting for women of colour and women to be at the forefront, particularly with things like Broad.
Mm.
Audre Lorde says there is no hierarchy of oppression, and there really isn't, but why do you focus on the things that you focus on?
I just feel like it's important that I do it. I do it for myself.
Yeah.
So that I know that I've got a place that I can make for myself, because I know from my experience that no one else is going to do it for me. I do it because there's also very few women of colour in broadcasting within our community, within the LGBTIQA community. There's a very clear lack of that. And I do it as well because I just feel that that is what I'm meant to do. You know,
yeah.
I come from a line of, on one side of my family, my mother's side, they're, heaven forbid, they're preachers and stuff like that. And on the other side, my dad's side, which is the Dutch-German side, they're broadcasters and they're involved in media and blah, 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 music and stuff. Mm. So it must be genetic. But apart from that, it's like a vehicle that I know it's not perfect because it is such a white space where I'm at Joy. It's not perfect at all. It's very hard sometimes. And I guess I sort of yoga a bit like that when I'm there, because it is hard to just focus and put my blinkers on and go in there and do what I know I'm going to do, because I know that maybe, just maybe, someone is listening. Sometimes I don't think people are listening, but I have time to think someone's listening, and if it can be a vehicle for other people of colour, other different backgrounds, other people with those experiences, and particularly, of course, definitely Indigenous women and trans women and gender non-conforming women to come in as a space, I'd rather that it was there than it was not there.
Yeah.
You know.
Being in those spaces, do you think that your way of being queer is different to
yeah,
other people's
it's
way of
definitely
being?
More it's more about me being it's more about me I am the cisgender woman, I am the woman of colour. It's more racially motivated, I guess, from external forces too.
Mm.
Whereas in New Zealand that wasn't such an issue, because when I did my broadcast course in New Zealand, Radio National, the person who was doing the training and teaching was a Pacific Islander woman.
Mm.
The broadcasters that I worked under were Māori. Language about the treaty was a constant dynamic entity that was there, and discussed those ideas and the politics from it. The land wars actually have become a thing, where they're now, it looks like there's going to be a national holiday to, not to celebrate, but to remember the land wars, which are still ongoing, but in courtrooms in New Zealand, all around the country. So when I came here to broadcast, it was just white people.
Yeah.
It was just, and cisgender. I didn't see very many trans or Whawhine, which is huge over there, like.
In New Zealand?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. New Zealand is a hodgepodge of culture, because Samoa, Tonga, Fiji, often it's go to New Zealand or go to Australia for education, and often New Zealand seems friendlier because it's another Pacific Island nation where you can go into the airport and the first thing you see is Maori welcome. How do you think that has influenced traditional Maori culture in terms of all of the Pacific Islander nations flocking to New Zealand?
When I was at school, it was like if you were a PI, you were a fucking coconut. Go back to where you came from. It was pretty racist within Māori culture. So Māori would not speak to Islanders because Islanders were taking Māori jobs. Blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
A lot of that was because the media pushed that. The white colonialist media would tell us what we were supposed to think. And then something called Bastion Point happened. And then the Springbok Tour happened in 1981.
Yeah.
And then it was like, it doesn't matter, we're all oppressed, because if our, you know, it became this global thing. If our black brothers and sisters are being oppressed in South Africa, and we're with them. We're all black brothers and sisters. Mm. So what happened is something called the Waka Hula happened. don't know if you've heard that term, the Wakahula. There was quite a bit of intermarriage relations, heteronormative relations, but also non-heteronormative relations between the different Pacific cultures. And now you go to schools, they have language nests for schools, not just to speak Māori, but also Te Kerere, but also to speak PI languages. So you'll have some parts of Auckland, for example, which will have maybe 15, 20,000 Samoans in one part of it. And then right next door, you might have Niueans, because everyone forgets about the Niueans. Like, only about two of them left. No, just kidding. Two of them left on the island, and then there's about 500 in Auckland. But that's another culture. And so people, there was a lot of intermixing, I guess you call it. Just those relations started. So, yeah, it's definitely changed, and it's changed Māori culture for the better, for the better for the culture within. And you'll see that in popular culture, like music, stuff like that. Coco Solids was over here. She's a fabulous queer woman, a brown queer woman. Her dad is Māori. Her mother is Tongan. So she's in her 20s. So it's like this great... And I think it brings strength from that, you know. I think that's important. And for queer cultures also benefited from that too.
If we look towards the future to a time where I personally can't imagine a time which is post-culture war, because it is always a war between opposing forces, between conservative and liberal, and there's always going to be pushing boundaries. I think that's part of our nature. But there's also the ongoing culture wars of imperialism that continue to exist in the world over and over again, and we spend more money and more resources towards that. But if we could imagine a future where there is much more of a reconciling between queer communities of colour and Western spaces of queer communities, if we could see a time where cultures or people of colour are interacting on a more equal basis, where our voices are equally at the forefront or equally as loud, what would that look like? And do you think that it would impact all of the unique intersections of identity that you have?
It would look pretty fucking amazing, first of all. And I think you would probably see... that's a really fucking hard question. Coming from an Indigenous perspective, you would see a lot more young Aboriginal people, obviously, in these spaces because they feel comfortable enough to be there, and they will see that it's okay to be in those spaces. As a black person, what I was saying before about, go out on a night and you only see like maybe a handful of other like queer people of colour out. And that would obviously have a huge effect on mental health then, and I mean, because within the Aboriginal community, I feel like there is a lot of suicide because of identity issues. Not even to do with them being gay, but just also being an Aboriginal person. So, yeah, I feel like if there was harmonious relationship between the Western queer community and non-Western queer community, I think it would just fix a lot of things.
Can you see anything positive from the... Like, you know, often as people of colour, we get in a space where we're very critical of Western culture because of our colonial past. And that colonial past has impacted us so greatly in terms of genocide, for example, which I think that, both of your nations very much experienced, mine not so much. What positive things has the modern LGBT movement and the modern culture war that the Western LGBT movement has been engaged in. What positive things has that brought to us as queer women of colour, do you think?
Well, I think having those spaces that are there to start with. But it's like we need to colonise those spaces for ourselves. You know, it's like they relinquish more of that power and stop thinking about, can we trust them? I get that often. Do you know what you're doing? Do you really know what you're doing? I get that question sometimes. Can you be trusted? All these other emotions as well that do come in and experiences from the past. But if it could be that power was relinquished more, let go more, and it could just be built on what's already there, it would be a much more inclusive, intersectional, and a healthier for everyone, because everyone benefits. You know, everyone benefits. I think the most important thing would be too, if the activism did look very long and hard at the relationship with Indigenous queer people on the spectrum, and looked at putting our weight behind a treaty in this country,
yeah.
Is my opinion. And we did that united with all the different colours, all the different skins and nations within this country, and the different languages and the different language groups. If the facilities are already there, let's get a chance to have access to them.
Yeah.
I think that's the best thing I can think of.
Yeah. What do you think has been a positive from the current or the culture wars that the Western LGBT movement have really fought for? What kind of positives can you see from that for queer women of colour?
Well, obviously, just the queerness part of your identity being accepted. Any human rights movement, regardless of what it has to do with, whether or not it's queerness, being a person of colour, whatever else, obviously has positives for everyone, because then, you know, it's starting to become more inclusive. That's I don't really know how else to answer that, because yeah. That's the only thing I can really think of. Which is a big thing, but...
Yeah. So it looks like that other panellist hasn't been able to make it today, but I'm going to open it up to the floor and ask the floor if they have any questions, and I'm happy to answer any as well.
I didn't even ask some of the questions.
Oh, what question didn't I ask that I sent? What question do you want me to ask? Quick, show me.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, does age have a role in how we experience queerness? That was a good question. I'm glad I asked you that question.
That was actually one of the questions where I was like, yes, but I don't know how. But I've kind of thought about it now. The way that I can kind of answer that question is, even though I'm not that old yet, compared to when I was in high school and compared to now, which has been 6-7 years, I've seen, I guess, I give less of a fuck now. That's because I've obviously been experiencing different forms of discrimination for, you know, the last however long, that it's gotten to a point now where I'm like, fuck it.
Yeah.
Like, just, you know, you are you kind of thing. And so that's how I now experience my queerness, whereas before it was a lot more of caring of what other people are going to think and, yeah, sort of worrying too much about how people not from those communities are going to view you. So I feel like, yes, age has played a role for me in how much I actually care about those identities or what other people think about my particular identities or things that I identify with.
Yeah. I guess the other question that I didn't ask is the question around women, queer women, and what are our experiences with other queer women that aren't women of colour, and what kind of ways do we experience solidarity, what kind of ways do we experience difference from your particular experience as a queer woman of colour. I'll throw that to you, Sonia.
What am I doing?
You're talking about, I guess I'm asking you because you do Broad,
yeah.
Which is a radio show dedicated to the experiences of queer women.
Yeah.
So what solidarity, what difference, what experiences do we share or not share that you've with women of colour?
Other women of colour.
As a woman of colour with other women. Like, I guess does colour play a role in our solidarity with other women?
Yes, it really does. And I think historically, particularly for feminism, you know, there's always that tension that's there. And I don't always think it's necessary now, in this day are in, that it's a deliberate type of thing. But I think it's because of historical mistakes going from the second wave of feminism. And there'll be queer women who are white feminists and women of colour who are feminists, of course.
Yeah.
And then there'll be women who are not queer or whatever they are feminists who are white. I think we've reached an interesting point in time where there is still that struggle to be heard, but that's becoming less so. And it does become difficult when they still want to have that space to be their platform, but they kind of want you to be some sort of representative of what their idea is of a woman of colour, a queer woman of colour, and a feminist. It becomes quite a tricky ground to walk across, because I'm friends with some of these people, so, and they, as Yoda said, you know, away put your weapon, I mean you no harm, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't...
That's you credit Zena, this one, Yoda.
And he was green, mostly. Vertically challenged, one could say. But, look, it's still navigating that way, and I think that relationship is getting healthier. I think in Australia we've got a great position to broaden ourselves with, to work together on things. And it's just about who dominates that space, whose voice is going to come through, and please invite me to everything. Do you know what I mean? That's what I have to constantly say to people. Look, I'm there. This is a platform for everyone. Talking about Broad, if you do have women of colour, Indigenous women of colour, etc., who are feminists, please, you know, I'm happy to certainly want them to speak. I certainly want them to have a place to speak and a space to speak.
Yeah.
And,
When you're talking about white women feminism, second wave feminism, so forth, it leads me to ask the question, in terms of that challenging relationship sometimes, where does class play a role in that?
Class is a big thing. I think in Australia it's a very big thing. Very class-based culture, particularly I noticed with the schooling systems here as well. However, on the other respect, that can be positive, that can be used for positive, but it would really be great if there were more time and place and spaces for women of all different backgrounds. I hate saying of all different classes, but generally we still are hearing the dominant, well-educated class speaking on behalf of all women. They can't really do that, obviously. I know, again, they probably don't mean to necessarily, but we are still hearing a little bit of that. That needs to change. I think it's the potential is there for it to improve.
Okay, I will open it up to the floor now. Is there any questions? Yes, this person had their hand up before.
Do you think the disability queer movement to be united with the Aboriginal Cree community?
I'll just repeat that question in case anybody didn't hear it. They're asking if they think that the queer disability community should be united with the queer Aboriginal community.
I think the all types of queer communities, whether or not it be Indigenous, non-Indigenous, or the disability queer movement as well, should all be united. I don't think that they should be separated at all, and that's kind of what I feel like we're trying to get from this whole conversation that we've had today, is that the queer community needs to be more inclusive of all the other sort of categories that fall within it, or all the other different groups of people that fall within it. And that's obviously something that's just going to take time and awareness from people who don't fit into those groups.
Yeah, and there is, of course, I imagine, people that are First Nation Australian and have a disability, and so therefore, you know, are part of a community that exists with those kinds of identities as well.
I just wanted to talk about something I found interesting. So I was working with Aboriginal, I have been working with Aboriginal queer people in Adelaide for a long time.
Yeah.
And I was doing a project which was about queer youth.
Yeah.
And so the queer young people, I was sort of working on the amount of flags there are, you know, transgender and agender and flags that I didn't know that existed. So then I was asking the Aboriginal young people which they identified with, and they said Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flags. Like, so in the display cabinet, they were there. The rainbow flag was there, but it wasn't the first one that Aboriginal young people and older Aboriginal queer people identified with. So I just thought that was... I mean, I just went, oh, of course. But I think that's to be said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks. It was just...
Yeah. Yeah, up the back.
I just want to say three things. I went to the Bloodwatch Foundation in Alice Springs to teach disability 8-year-old Aboriginal girls. And as I was accepted, ASIC cut all the fundings.
Yeah.
Bang, it went. The second thing is that Stan, I think his surname's Thomas, I'm not certain on that one, he's the Minister of Aborigines, and he's quoted recently that there's 36,000 Aborigines or Indigenous people doing graduate degrees at university, which is absolutely phenomenal. And I think that when Indigenous can achieve at the same level as anyone else, I think that they're losing they're gaining the battle of racialism. But the third one was that I met Bumper, who started the march in the Wellington, and I had a talk to her about the situation with the Maori groups. And he said there's 8 different Maori groups in New Zealand, and some have empathy for sexualities, and there's a couple that don't. So the variation amongst the Indigenous has different groups with different levels of tolerance for different sexualities. So it's not all the same. Apparently 2 or something didn't. So it wasn't all uniform in that Maori sense. So I don't know if you can add on to any of that.
I think it not being uniform would obviously be the effect of colonisation and how much one area has been consistently brainwashed, essentially, by colonisation. Like I was saying before, my mum's side is quite Catholic, and because of that, growing up with that, originally I was quite homophobic, or, you know, just had no like, you know, I was only being told that it was wrong to be gay or whatever, so that's why there would be different views amongst different groups. It just depends on sort of how they've been brought up in the with the Western culture.
There's, well, traditionally there's the seven different wakas or canoes that came to New Zealand. That may be what you're referring to.
Yeah.
One of those canoes was actually driven or piloted, I don't want to say, I'm going to say manned, by women, actually, of the Te Awa nation. And so they've got quite a staunchly matriarchal, matrilineage, and they're not as conservative. However, within those confines, as Danny was saying, there is, of course, Christianity, which has had a massive genocidal impact upon those different groups. And there's so many different subgroups to those seven original groups, and then subgroups to those groups, and subgroups, and so on and so on. And it's now so diverse, but at the same time, we can't forget the colonisation that has impacted and created a very patriarchal, very conservative, hateful kind of culture, which is unfortunate, but, you know, thankfully there's a treaty and those things
I think some
are
of
being addressed.
I think some of indigenous culture at the back of it, though, isn't it? Is that diversion?
Oh, yes, yes. But what I'm saying is the conservative elements, elements that don't accept the different sexual nuances as such, are from a colonised perspective.
God help us with Trump in America.
Yeah. That's true, yeah.
I was just wondering, like, from both of your comments today, there's a lot of talk about your movement between different spaces and obviously home in Broome and home here and New Zealand and here, and I just wonder if that is a constant battle or negotiation of just kind of where you feel at most home and where you feel at most comfortable, or is it just kind of like just an obvious thing you have to negotiate and just finding your people in lots of different spaces?
You find the people in so many different spaces.
Yeah.
Like I said, when I arrived here almost 20 years ago, 16 years ago, something like that, there wasn't as many spaces, and it was definitely not a very inclusive perspective to things. That's changed, thankfully, because I think there's more people trying to open up those spaces and realising that we need that inclusion, but of course it's a long way to go. I kind of call myself an Aussie wee now.
Ah.
An Aussie wee. I've been here so long, I can't go back, do you know what I mean? But I've made so many great connections and important discoveries about who I am and the roles and things that I do, broadcasting and stuff like that, that I wouldn't be able to do it anywhere else. To be honest, I wouldn't have been able to have those opportunities if I stayed in Aotearoa in the early 2000s, you know. Things have so changed. I get so jealous when I see people like Coco Solids and Anika Moore. You know, I mean, she's right in Melbourne at the moment, so she's got a gig tonight, apparently. The Ding Dong, but no, she hasn't paid me to say that. It's like she's gone from a queer woman who, great talent, could sing and stuff, that no one really, you know, she's a bit of an underground sensation. She now has her own television show and gets to interview amazing people, and that's why I hate her so much. Maybe if I'd stayed, but no, it's not about that. The journey I've taken, for all of it, you know, cliche, the journey, means that, yeah. For Indigenous people, we believe that we have a purpose to, I guess, be guardians in some respect, and that's why I'm really... Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but that's why I'm really supportive of what's happening in North Dakota right now. And I stand with Standing Rock. It's a fight that's the start of a fight for clean water and access to clean water. And it would be great to see the fight happen here, I suppose. I just went off on tangent, sorry.
Yeah.
That's
a good one.
Yes. You asked if it's always been a struggle. I guess... for me, I didn't really start to think about it too much until the last couple of years, especially last year with the 150 community closure stuff. And I mean, I've always been struggling with, you know, the kind of whole two worlds thing of being an Aboriginal person in a white society, and how do I walk between both of those? And that's been something I experienced, especially when I moved to Melbourne, because I went to boarding school here and then I stayed for university. And so I guess it's the same kind of thing with being black and being gay. I suppose it's gotten a bit easier in some regards, but it depends on, like, the moment that I'm in. For example, right now, it's not that easy because, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening back in community that, you know, they're reviving language and things like that, and that's stuff I want to be there for. Because back home, because there's still quite a high population of Indigenous people, if you move away and you come back and you forget the names of certain places or certain animals, you're losing your culture, and Indigenous people will say that to you. So that's, they'll call you white, mm-hmm. basically. Yeah. So
they give you a knife and fork.
yeah.
That's what they do. You get in the knife and fork.
Yeah, so it's not...
I get called a coconut.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was something that I was going to touch on earlier, is that there is ignorance from both communities, the black community and the gay community, for each other, kind of thing. But yeah, it just depends on kind of where your head is at the time, whether or not it's a big struggle or a little struggle. Yeah.
Thanks, guys. I was wondering if you have any reflections on how the political struggles of queer communities and Indigenous communities engage with each other. And of course, they're not naturally separate struggles, but in practice, Australian queer struggles tend to be very white and forgetful of the fact that they take place on land that is unceded. So I wonder if you have any comments on how, as movements, those connections emerge. In particular, how the particularly white queer movement in Australia engages with or fails to engage with Indigenous struggles.
I think it comes down to the fact that Australia as a country is so unaware and so fucking ignorant. And I feel like, yeah, the white queer community needs to kind of open the doors up a bit more to become aware about the issues that Indigenous people face, and sort of bring have more Indigenous faces at the forefront of the movement. That's not necessary. That's not a queer, white queer community issue. That's just a whole Australian issue that, you know, people are unaware and ignorant. But yeah, it's kind of a bit bigger than that.
It's a hard one to...
Because
it's still that between the two worlds. You don't... It's also... You get kind of... Well, I do. I get kind of fearful. Will that space be taken away from me if I demand it? You know, if I go in there and say, right, I want my voice to be heard, I want my people's voice to be heard, I want the people here, you know, we're going to talk about what does queerness, blackness and treaty mean? What does a queer, black, Indigenous, global movement look like? What does it look like? Do we know? I don't think so, but how do we express that if we don't have those spaces, you know? Do we have to fight for those as well? Should we be fighting for those? I don't think so. So we're just going to give them a two on a platter. That's offensive. It's hard because you do live with this fear. Well, funding cuts come, will we be, you know, the first things to go? Opportunities? Are people who are in charge of the money and the access to resources, I should call it resources, are they white? What's their agenda? Because everyone has an agenda, particularly in the queer community. It's always agenda-driven. What sort of agenda? And in that agenda, is it tokenism or is it actual representation, actual intersectionality? I think we're still in the early stages for queer culture.
I think it's an interesting question. You know, thinking about it from my perspective as a queer woman of colour from Fiji, who has a daughter who is a queer woman, First Nations Indigenous person, and so grappling with the racism that exists in Australia, and she experiences racism very similarly to me, like, where are you from, or, you know, are you being too loud and too political and too
angry,
in your face,
angry.
But also differently, because this is her land as well, and she knows her land, and she knows her language group, she knows her elders. And I think that all people should be really not only knowledgeable about, but engaged in the Indigenous struggles here, and that all of the struggles are interlinked. They are really interlinked. And yet we don't seem to be able to see that.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
How do you think that...
can you speak up?
Yeah, sorry. I'm struggling to speak. How do you think that the queer community could approach that? You know, like, I think a lot of people in the LGBT community don't even know how to start to understand. I mean, I think they all need to stop talking so much and listen a lot more. But, you know, what do you think?
Well, there's organisations like this, Black Rainbow.
Yeah.
There's people like Brian Andy. He's fabulous, fabulous. Yeah. Kudu man, Indigenous man. There are organisations. There's NITV, as far as broadcasting go, fabulous. They've got a website. I guess it's just conversing, getting in touch with them, asking them the questions that, you know, like, what can we do? Start an introduction that way, you know. What do you want? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, that's an issue that Australia has, is that anything related to the Indigenous people, they don't actually ask Indigenous people.
Yeah.
They just assume what they want or you know.
I guess, I think as a broader community, we're always really focused on who our allies are. And I also think that we need to think about what kind of ally we are and who we're allies to. I always have this assumption that I expect people to understand people of colour issues. I expect that of every single person in this room, but I expect for myself to be on top of, you know, trans issues, and I'm a cisgendered person. I expect myself to be on, you know, to be an ally, an outspoken ally, a person that actually creates change around disability issues. And I do the best that I can, whether it's broadcasts, whether it's hosting panels or whatever, to be the best ally I can be. And so in what I would say to that question is, you know, look at yourself and go, you know, how can I be, what kind of ally do I want to be? And how can I be that ally? And then go out and find the resources, find the people to do that.
The culture wars, you know, are often played out in the media. And Sonia just mentioned NITV and a couple of broadcasters there. I mean, it made me think of something that happened on Joy earlier this year, the radio station where you broadcast, where Pauline Hanson was interviewed by one of the programs. And there was some debate in the community about whether she should have been on this program or the station at all. I guess another debate about why, over a long interview, interviewers managed to fail to ask her any questions about race at all. And I was sort of wondering whether within Joy, I mean, the queer, Australia's queer, or other sort of queer media outlets, did that promote much of a debate about...
It didn't promote enough of a debate about, A, for me personally, and I know for a lot of people of colour who, and Muslim people too, because they're often left out, Muslim queer people, in spaces. The debate was, you know, about same-sex equality, and it came back again to same-sex marriage. It seemed that was the point of having her on. I can't exactly remember some of the questions, but I basically had to turn off because I was so upset. And that was the podcast I was listening to. I just couldn't keep listening to it. There wasn't enough of a debate of just why. It wasn't taken to the next step of if you're going to have someone as racist and as abhorrent as that on a community broadcast program, you need to at least acknowledge the Indigenous culture, the Indigenous land that that's broadcast from. You also need to acknowledge the people that she and her followers hurt by their existence in politics in this country, and you need to invite Indigenous people, Muslim queer people as well, and women to take those, and yes, of course, non-cisgender people to do those questions. Those were the broadcasters that I would have had ask those questions, but as far as I'm aware, there was no conversation about that, so... Personally, I was really, really disappointed.
Yeah, so was I.
Really disappointed. Mm-hmm. But that's my take on it.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah?
With the gathering in New Zealand and the government gave the gathering their full backing, or... Is it still in, is the guy community still talking to the government about these things, and then the government's deciding not willing to give the guy community in New Zealand some money to do a lot of projects?
Yeah, there's been some really good stuff that's happened. Obviously, it was a very exciting time when the same-sex equality... bill got passed.
Well, that's right, you've got marriage
over. Yes, yes. It was exciting because it was a very Indigenous moment as well, because a Waiata or Indigenous song was sung in Parliament, and it was a Māori queer lesbian woman who passed that, she was the one who lobbied for that bill, introduced the bill, sorry. And so it was a queer... brown moment. It was great. It was wonderful, and I think the YouTube just went off the off the scale there. Since then, there's been John Key, and since then, if any Conservative government, it's always going to be very difficult. I haven't kept up with the queer politics as such, but I do know that there's rumblings, and I'm not just talking the earthquakes. But.
With the Pauline Hanson thing, I remember 20 years ago when she was in Parliament the first time around, she said that people with disabilities should not be seen and should not be heard. What do you think of that comment that she said 20 years ago about disability?
I think people should have been listening 20 years ago, so we wouldn't have that person who reeks of hatred. She reeks of hatred, and she is a beacon to people of hatred. I don't think she should have been allowed back in.
Do you think Pauline worse than Donald?
I think... I'm hoping that they don't meet. Do you know? I'd hate to see the love child out of that.
It'd be a hate child.
Hate child.
Yeah.
But sometimes children rebel, so you don't know.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's great. Okay, it's 4:30. We're going to wrap up. I'm really sorry that other panellists couldn't make it. I think that they would have really contributed something valuable. But I really want to thank you for coming along. I really want to thank you for taking the time and to stop and sit and listen to queer women of colour's voices. I think that's really important, and really thank you for that, even though I know that sometimes it might be uncomfortable. You sat with that, and so thank you for being the allies that you are and for the camaraderie that you bring. I really want to thank Dani Sid. She's actually an extraordinary vocalist and singer-songwriter. She's really embarrassed. This is how we met on stage. Check her out. And check out Broad.
Play some of your music.
Where's Broad?
Where is it?
What time is it?
Monday
night. Monday
night. It's tomorrow. No. Is it Sunday?
No, no,
it's
Sunday.
Okay. It's good.
It's Monday night at 10 o'clock.
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. So check out Broad. Anything else?
No, thank you for coming along.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Feel the friendship. That's right.
And it's really hard to tell people that. One of the questions I really want to ask you in your dealings with the white women, what you know, you guys are going to do is, I had a conversation earlier. You know, he's got the flooding experiences, so they're not all black people, right? No, it's just, it's really hard.
No, we didn't have any of that.
It's on the news, but I take it for granted.
Thank you. You've been listening to a broadcast on Joy 94.9.
Even though it was a lose-lose. This love was too great to waste away. I try not to lie, but the truth seems to truth to be spoken. At the time it seemed better than leaving you broken, but the time
Broad on Joy.
It's yes. Broadcasting, yeah.
Broadcasting, yeah, yeah. Like broad, like broads, like women, broads.
Broad on Joy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
949.
Your name first too. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
Masha Alekhina from Pussy Riot. Broad on Joy 949.
That's great.
My God.
Sorry. Natalia Kalada, Broad on Joy 949.
Thank you very much. That's great. Cool.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.